Good morning and welcome to this two-hour Main Street Radio special from Minnesota's newest prison at Rush City. I'm Rachel Reby. We're going to look at Minnesota's prison system and this facility, an $89 million concrete complex built on farmland about an hour north of the Twin Cities. At noon, we'll talk about what happens to these inmates after they get out of prison. They've served their time, but are we willing to let them live and work among us? We're broadcasting today from the library of the Rush City Prison. It's located in the support building, which also houses the cafeteria, gymnasium, classrooms, and workspace for prison industries. My guests this morning are Minnesota Commissioner of Corrections Cheryl Ramstead Voss, Tom Johnson, Director of the Council on Crime and Justice, and joining us from the NPR Bureau at the State Capitol is Representative Wes Skoglund, a Minneapolis DFLer and longtime member of the Judiciary Committee. Good morning. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
We also have a number of inmates and prison staff members in our audience today at the library. Thank you for joining us. Listeners, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments. If you're in the Twin Cities, you can call us today at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. If you're outside of the metropolitan area, call us at 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. This prison, the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Rush City, opened in February. There are 225 men housed inside these walls today, only about a fourth of the prison's capacity. But officials expect it to be full by the year 2003. Commissioner Voss, we've seen Minnesota's prison population almost double in the last 10 years. Why the dramatic increase?
Well, Rachel, the prison population, in fact, has almost tripled in the last 15 years. To give you some numbers, 2,323 inmates were in our system January of 1985. January of 2000, we had nearly 6,000 inmates in our adult correctional facilities. And the reasons are many. First of all, I think law enforcement has stepped up its efforts and resulting in a greater number of prosecutions. I think the sentencing of criminal activity has increased, longer sentences have resulted, and I think that in general there's just been more of a focus on law enforcement over the course of the last 15 years. There's been a greater number of people incarcerated for drug offenses than ever before in the history of the state. In fact, 1998, almost a quarter of the inmates coming into our system were for drug-related offenses.
When you spoke at the grand opening here at the end of January, you said that you hope in your lifetime this will be the last prison that is opened in Minnesota. But if we're talking about this facility being full in 2003 and the increases continuing to go up, where are they going?
Rachel, I think that the time has never been more appropriate to revisit how we are utilizing our state's resources and the need to leverage our resources to ensure that we are making the best use of our community-based treatment facilities. It's interesting to note that one of the two largest chemical dependency treatment providers in the state is the Department of Corrections. Maybe some of those people who are primarily in the system because of chemical dependency problems ought not to be taking up $30,000 a year beds inside the Department of Corrections facilities. Certainly we see at the legislature the legislation dealing with sex offenders and now the proposed legislation dealing with making DWI a felony bodes for needing to visit some tough issues and make some very thoughtful decisions about going forward from here with utilization of our prison beds.
Representative Skoglund, what would you have to say about the public's appetite for more prisons or the public's appetite for locking up people longer? Do they want it and are they willing to pay for it?
Well, I don't know about locking them up longer. I think the public is willing to lock people up for committing certain crimes. Length of sentence gets to be debatable as to how long they want to put people away. You look at the sex offenders, though, I think the public very clearly wants these people off the street, and there is one case of where I think length of sentence does matter.
But in terms of treatment program for sex offenders, are we making any headway?
Oh, it's hard to say. We certainly offer probably the best treatment programs in the United States. I really have to compliment the Department of Corrections for everything that they do, but I think only through long-term studies, years and years of follow-up after they're released from prison, will we really be able to know whether they work or not. I have to ask your technical people, I'm getting a feedback, I'm hearing my words 2 seconds after I say them, so if they could correct my headphones, I'd appreciate it.
We'll try to take care of that for you.
Thank you.
Even though we talk about this dramatic increase in the prison population, we still have to keep in mind that Minnesota has the lowest incarceration rate in the country. Why is that?
Are you asking me?
If you'd like to answer it, that'd be great.
I don't have a good answer for that. I do know that the data shows... Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, this is Wes Coughlin. Keep track of who's who. Most people who commit felonies don't get sent to prison in this state. The state of Minnesota sends about only 1 out of 5 felons to prison, about 1 out of 6 drug offenders, and about 1 out of 6 property offenders to prison. Most people who commit felonies do not get sentenced to the state prison system. Most of them may get jail time or local probation time, but they do not get sentenced to the state prison. So we are a very low incarceration rate state, actually the lowest in the nation.
Representative Skoglund is certainly correct, Rachel, and the philosophy has been in Minnesota to lock up the worst of the worst and to try to deal with as many people through our community corrections, which is very strong in this state. And so many people do not end up in prison until they've committed multiple felonies. And you might find differences of opinion on whether that's the way that corrections ought to be handled in Minnesota, but it's certainly, I think, been the view over the years, and that's why our prison population is the lowest in the country.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, I would just add to that that while the aggregate imprisonment rate is the lowest in the nation, that's a result of our having the lowest incarceration or imprisonment rate for whites. The imprisonment rate for whites is about 63 per 100,000. That's substantially lower than the imprisonment rate for the next state, which is North Dakota, which has an imprisonment rate for whites of 101. After that, the states are even significantly higher than North Dakota. The imprisonment rates for African Americans, for example, is about at the midpoint of all of the states, but because our population, or because our total population is primarily Caucasian, the overall rate works out to be the lowest, but it is a consequence of the very low rate of imprisonment rate for whites in the state.
And why do you think that is?
That's a good question, and one of the issues that we're looking at by way of research is to ask why the large racial disparity, and there's two parts to that. You know, why the large number of minorities within the criminal justice system, and the other is, should there be more Caucasians within the system?
Our phone number is 651-227-6000 if you're in the Twin Cities. If you're outside the metro area, call us this morning on our Main Street special, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. We go to Ashir, who is in St. Paul. Good morning. Welcome to Main Street.
What is the racial makeup of the inmates? And what percentage is for terrorism? It's the best time for reflection, I understand, and I hope there are books in the library that you are speaking from on comparative religion. Thank you.
Let's go with the first question. The racial makeup of the inmates in Minnesota's prison system. Commissioner?
Well, Rachel, the population in our prisons among the adult prison population is 46.4% Caucasian, 37.2% African American, 7.3% Hispanic, 7% American Indian, and 2.1% are of other races.
So we have a majority of inmates in Minnesota prisons are people of color, although they represent a very small percentage of Minnesota's population in whole. So our prison population is not in any way representative of the population at large. Would that be correct?
That's correct, Rachel. 53.6% of our prison population are non-Caucasian.
Mr. Johnson has said that they are launching a study to try to find out why. What's your sense?
Rachel, I think that it is a result of several factors. I certainly don't have any research of my own, and I'm very glad that Tom Johnson and the council are engaging in this project, because I think it's really important to look at all of the contributing factors. I suspect, however, that there is a difference at each stage. In other words, I think that there's a difference among stops on the street, among those who are getting prosecuted, among those who are prosecuted and convicted, what happens to their sentences. And I think it's incumbent upon everyone in the system to really examine what is contributing to the racial imbalance, because it certainly is dramatic and it's something we ought to all be concerned about. I chair the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and in that capacity as well, I really am eager for this information to be available. But it's not going to be an easy study, and I think the analysis is going to be very critical to what we can do to change the trend that we've seen over the course of time. Just by way of comparison, over the period between 1990 and 1997, the number of black inmates serving time in state prisons for violent offenses increased by 69%, whereas for Caucasians it increased by 47%. So we really need to look at whether there is discrimination, and if so, at what levels, and how we what we can do to change that.
We go to Bridget, who is on the phone from Minneapolis. Good morning, Bridget. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. So, with respect to the talks of the different ethnicities that are there in prison, I do believe, from my own personal experience, that ethnicity should not be an issue. When I was 14 years old here in St. Paul, Minnesota, I was raped by a repeated sex offender at knife point. He had been in prison for so many different offenses relating to sex offenses, and also he had also been through sex offender treatment repeated times. And it has very seriously had a detrimental on my entire life later on, as now I am 26 years old, and I just feel that a crime that vicious should not look at, it should not look at whether or not the inmate is of any descent, whether they're black, white, sighted, not sighted, handicapped or not. I feel that that is an issue, that is a major problem. I feel that if you're a Caucasian male and you commit a sex offense, that you're more apt to get a lesser sentence than if you were an African American, and I don't think it matters to the victim who sustains the damages. And I also don't believe that there should at any time be good behavior releases for sex offenders, and I do believe, with respect to one of the gentleman's comments on the show earlier, that sex offenses should be looked at for long, long term. And I would hate for anybody else to have to endure what I've endured.
Thank you for your call this morning. Representative Skoglund, is there discussion in the legislature? Is there always discussion in the legislature about how to handle sex offenders, how to treat them, how long to lock them up, how to rehabilitate them?
Well, this year we did lengthen the sentences for sex offenders, for people who commit first-degree criminal sexual conduct. Basically, the sentence is going to go from an 8-year sentence to a 12-year sentence. Additionally, we allowed the crimes that may go with criminal sexual conduct, such as breaking into the house, a burglary, other forms of assault, terrorism and so on. We allow that to be stacked one upon the other if the courts will allow it. And so there will be longer sentences for criminal sexual conduct as well. There should be. In terms of treatment, yeah, we talk about that, but we really leave that to the professionals, or we try to leave it to the professionals. I think the people at the Department of Corrections are in a far better position to determine just what the treatment should be.
Thank you. Any other comments about her call, Commissioner?
Just briefly, with respect to the treatment of sex offenders, that is certainly a priority for the Department of Corrections. And in fact, our recidivism study recently published shows that we are having some very positive effects from the treatment that takes place inside prison. So we're mindful of the need to address the underlying issues once somebody has committed the crime and is inside the prison system.
We are broadcasting from Minnesota's newest prison at Rush City. Our reporter Leif Anger is out in the hallway with Rush City Warden Bert Mose. Good morning, Leif.
Morning, Rachel. We're standing in an area just outside of the prison library. From here, I can see the cafeteria through heavy glass. I can see a sort of observation deck through heavy glass again. To get where we're standing earlier, we passed 2.5 miles of razor wire fence through the front door and through 6 separate sliding doors, each one clanging shut just like they do in every prison movie that you have ever seen, probably. And I'm with Bert Mose here, the warden. Bert, you've been doing this job for a long time, many years, at Lino Lakes, and here you are in a prison facility so new that the grass isn't even up yet. Is this perfect? Is this ideal?
This is an ideal job for a warden from the perspective that we're opening a new prison. We're able to bring in staff from a variety of other institutions that requested to transfer here, and we are able to develop the program from the ground up. So in that sense, it's ideal.
Right now, the inmates are passing right through this corridor control area on their way to lunch. Quite a few of them, most of them looking like young guys. What do they do, Bert, to get in here? Not each one of them, of course, but what crimes have these guys committed?
If you look at the percentage of felonies in the state of Minnesota, the highest percentage is our sex offenses. And so if this were an average group, the highest percentage would be sex offenders, robbery, homicide, drug offenses. So, you know, that would be the kind of offenses that a lot of these inmates would have committed to get here. All of the inmates that are here now transferred from Stillwater or St. Cloud, which are level 5 facilities, and they, through the classification system, became level 4, and will eventually, a lot of them will move to level 3s.
What little most of us know about prisons we probably got from movies. And you've been leading a lot of tours through here, you and your staff. What things have surprised the moviegoers who come through and see what a real level 4 prison is like?
A lot of people have the impression of a prison from Shawshank Redemption or Murder in the First. And this does not look like that. It is very technological with touch screens. And the place is very clean. A lot of the prison movies, they don't show that. Inmates are busy. They're working in industry. They're involved in educational programming. And they've adjusted to doing their time in this facility. I think the one thing that impressed people the most was looking at the individual cells. And we have all double cells here, except for segregation. And most people's comments are, I couldn't do 5 years in a cell like that.
Two men living in a 7-foot by 13-foot cell. A tall guy could reach across and touch both walls of the room.
That's correct. You know, and one of the things that we've attempted to do through programming here is we have, and we'll have more inmates working in industry. We will work 3 shifts, 24 hours a day. And in that way, we will try to keep 2 inmates from spending an inordinate amount of time in the cell together.
keep the peace a little bit. This is a level four facility, as you said, meaning it's between medium security and high security. How is this new prison a more secure place than a level three, for example?
One of the biggest differences between this prison and Alaina Lakes, for instance, is all of our cells are what we call wet cells. They have toilet facilities, water in the cell, and when we lock inmates down at night at 10 o'clock, the doors are all locked. Every inmate is in their cell and counted. We don't have to open the door until the next morning. In a medium, they do not have wet cells, and Alaina Lakes, for instance, that I know the best because I was there, we would have 1,000 inmates, and if they have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, they walk out of the door, and the perimeter is secure, but the inmates have a great deal of freedom of movement within the facility. Here, inmates only move where we allow them to move through sliders under our direction.
Right now, you've got 225 inmates here. When it's full, it'll have 950 or so. How hard will it be to control all those daily schedules and keep things running smoothly?
The schedule that we will have to have will be like a train schedule, is that it will be tight. We have two dining rooms. Inmates will switch into one dining room. When they do switch in, the door locks. The next group will come out of the other one, and then another group will move in. And we need to do that efficiently to be able to give every group of inmates 25 minutes to eat. They get 25 minutes from the time they walk through that door until they walk back out to get their tray and eat.
And they have assigned seats, as I understand.
There is an officer in there that fills tables, and they direct inmates to sit. We fill table one first, then we go to table two, then we go to table three, and the inmates sit where the officer tells them. It avoids grouping by, in gang affiliation or other affiliation, and it keeps the dining room more orderly.
Okay, finally, is newer better, I have to ask?
Is newer better? Yes, newer is better. Opening a new prison with all of the electronics, the sliders and the doors. We've gone through some shakedown phase of making sure that everything works right, but in the long run, it will be better. Because of the way the prison is designed, we have one of the best staff-to-inmate ratios in the department, and that affects our per diem, and that's an issue that we are being looked at for. Is the cost per day per inmate.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special Main Street Radio broadcast from the Minnesota Correctional Facility at Rush City. I'm Rachel Reby. We're talking about Minnesota's prison system with our guest, Representative Wes Skoglund, Tom Johnson, Director of the Council on Crime and Justice, and Minnesota Corrections Commissioner Cheryl Ramstead Voss. We'll be back with more of Main Street after this break for news headlines.
Coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening.
It's been 25 years since the fall of Saigon, and today Vietnam is a face of change, where the government campaigns against social ills, and young people crowd cyber cafes and English classes. NPR's broadcast journalist series presents Revisiting Vietnam, an evening with award-winning investigative reporter Daniel Zwerdling, Monday, May 1st at 7:30 at McAllister College Chapel in St. Paul. Free tickets are available at the Wedge Community Co-op in Minneapolis or Valley Natural Foods in Burnsville.
Good morning with news from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Greta Cunningham. Miami's Police Chief William O'Brien has quit, saying he can't keep working for a mayor who's dividing the city over the Ilian Gonzalez case. Yesterday, the city manager was fired after refusing to fire O'Brien. The mayor is angry that O'Brien did not give him advance warning about the raid to rescue Ilian from his Miami relatives. The immigration agent who led the Ilian Gonzalez raid is speaking out in defense of the armed, and authorities were worried about armed resistance from angry protesters. He also says his agents never pointed a gun at the child. Microsoft stock is faring well so far as the government prepares to submit its proposal for sanctions in the antitrust case. The government is expected to ask today that the software giant be split into two competing companies that can't reunite for at least a decade. Vice President Gore is in Texas today to talk up his education plans. At a campaign stop in Dallas, Gore will unveil a proposal that the government will withhold some federal money from failing schools. It's similar to an idea GOP rival George W. Bush has outlined. Bush is the governor of Texas. Rescue workers say at least two dozen people are dead. At least two people are dead, and dozens of Haitian migrants have been rescued after their ship ran aground in the southern Bahamas. The U.S. Coast Guard has evacuated about 65 people. Many were suffering from severe hypothermia, dehydration, and kidney failure. The Coast Guard says they were flown by helicopter to nearby hospitals. A Bahamian Defense Force ship is also taking more than 200 survivors to Nassau. The shipwrecked survivors will eventually be returned to Haiti. In regional news, the State Department of Transportation is honoring workers who have been injured or killed while building or maintaining Minnesota's highways. The department will observe a moment of silence at 2 this afternoon in memory of the 19 MnDOT workers who have been killed on the job since 1960. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for sunshine in the west, partly cloudy skies in the east, high temperatures near 58 to 68 degrees. Tonight, clear skies statewide with lows ranging from 35 to 45 degrees. Checking conditions around the region, St. Cloud reports fair skies and 58 degrees. It's cloudy in Rochester and 56. Duluth reports fair skies and 49. And in the Twin Cities, partly cloudy skies, a temperature of 59. That's a look at the latest news.
Welcome back to our Main Street special, live from Minnesota's newest prison at Rush City. I'm Rachel Reby. This prison has 825 doors, 325 digital video cameras to record movement both inside and outside the prison, and a mile-long, 12-foot-high fence laced with razor wire. We're set up in the prison library to talk about Minnesota's prison system with our guest, Tom Johnson, director of the Council on Crime and Justice and former Hennepin County attorney, Minnesota's Commissioner of Corrections, Cheryl Ramstead-Voss, and Representative Wes Skoglund, who is joining us from the state capitol. If you are in the Twin Cities and you would like to call and ask a question or contribute a comment, you can do so by calling 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside of the metropolitan area, call us at 1-800-242-2828. And we go to our phone lines now. Ruth is standing by from Holly. Good morning, Ruth. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question. I am a single person. My daughter lives with me. I work full-time at the telephone company. I make between $30,000 and $35,000 a year. And from that money, after taxes, I pay a mortgage on a bi-level and 8 acres in the country. I pay all the associated bills that go with that, heat and electric and cable. I drive 58 miles round trip daily to work. My daughter lives with me, and I buy all the groceries. And I have money left to give public radio and public TV and other charities that I appreciate. And I'm curious why it costs $30,000, which is almost as much as I make, to keep one prisoner for 1 year.
Commissioner, why don't you address that? The cost of incarceration in Minnesota, $36,918 per prisoner, among the highest in the nation. Why is it so expensive?
There are economies of scale when you have a larger prison population than Minnesota does. We have a small prison population, but we have to provide security, we have to provide the treatment opportunities, we have to provide for inmates as if we have a system that has a lot more inmates, and thus the per capita cost per inmate is much greater than systems that have a much larger population. I will tell you, though, that, Rachel, we are currently looking at the per diem costs in Minnesota and have gotten some consultants who are assisting us in trying to look at how we can do things more economically and try to drive those costs down, because that is a concern of mine, certainly a concern of the governor, and we are going to do whatever we possibly can, given the small prison population that we have, to try to bring the costs in line.
And I'm assuming that the double bunking here at Rush City was certainly because of cost, and that was very controversial, saying, is that even safe to put two people in a room that small? But you can hold double the inmates.
That's right, and throughout our system, almost all institutions that we run have double bunking now for that very reason, to try to reduce the cost per inmate to incarcerate.
Representative Skoglund, we have higher costs. Do we have better results than other states?
I don't think so. I don't think we have better results than North Dakota, which has lower costs, or Wisconsin that has lower costs. I think we have equal results, but I don't think we have better results. We have the highest per diems in the United States, and it's something the legislature is very concerned about. Our per diems are far higher than the federal system that double bunks, triple bunks, uses dorm rooms almost to incarcerate prisoners. And I think that we do need to do far more to bring down our costs. I think amongst the things that we need to be doing are getting more people working in the prison. Most people in the prison probably don't have a job in the prison. And we need to be developing our industry program and getting more inmates to be working to bring in more income to the prison. Go to the federal prison, virtually everybody works. In our prison, I'm not sure what it is, Commissioner, but I'd say about 30%, 40% of the people are employed.
Actually, the idleness numbers in our system are very, very much smaller than that. It's under 25% of the inmates are not engaged if they're not in treatment.
I think you and I have the same card in front of us, and I see inmates employed 856 out of the 5,900. And
I think we're talking a little differently because you're talking about employment. I'm talking about idleness.
Talking about employment. I think we need to have more people employed bringing income into the prison, more people doing prison work, bringing on outside income.
Would that mean working instead of taking classes?
Well, I think if they take classes, they should still have to work. Most college students, most high school students have jobs on the side. I know very few that don't. I had to. I imagine you did. And most kids today have to do it. And I think even if they're taking high school classes or college classes, they should have to work. It's a basic of life.
What do you think about that, Commissioner?
Well, I don't disagree with Representative Skoglund. I think we have to balance, though, if we've got inmates working around the clock and doing treatment and taking classes, it's going to drive the cost of security up because it costs money to be able to have people out of their cells and out in the general population around the clock. So it's a balancing process. I don't disagree. In fact, I've been very proactive in terms of trying to seek private public partnerships. We now have a prison laundry business that's a direct result of trying to go after opportunities to increase the number of inmates who are able to work within our prison system.
And I understand in Rush City, when they opened it up and said what industries would like to be interested, there was a stampede to the door. So industry is interested in getting involved in partnerships. Mr. Johnson, what did you want to add?
Two quick points. One, there is a cost attached to investing in preparing inmates for their release back into the community, and I'm sure that the percentage is very high, and probably nationally I think it's about 95% of all inmates get released, and I would guess that's about the same, maybe a little higher even in Minnesota. So that's a good investment, and we shouldn't back away from that. Secondly, to the extent that the per diem would be lowered by increasing the prison population, we need to keep in mind that the total amount spent will go up, and so the total cost to the taxpayer will still go up, even though the per diem might, that is the cost per prisoner per year, might look more favorable. So we have to keep in mind what the aggregate dollars is and how much the taxpayers are paying in total. So we need to keep a balanced approach here.
We go now to Minneapolis, where Kathy is standing by. Good morning, Kathy. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. I was just listening to this, and I'm sitting here at work, and I'm very much appalled at Rush City, period. And I am appalled because of the numbers that they are not looking at, and they should look at those numbers of African-Americans in Minneapolis alone that is locked up. And the cause is this probable cause law and driving while black, which we call DWB. You cannot go on Lindale Avenue at night, nor Broadway, and please don't come from over northeast Minneapolis if you black at night, because the police, the lights are on you, they stopping you, and then when they stop you, they say, do you know why I am stopping you? And you look at them all stupid and say, why in the hell are you stopping me? And then they will say, well, you didn't have your lights on, or your windows are tinted too dark, little things. Then they proceed to search your car. And all of our African-American young men are being locked up. This Rush City is built to lock them up. Rush City is built to hire relatives and friends. They need to stop doing that off of our tax dollars at these prisons and these jails. They're building a new jail downtown Minneapolis already. It's driving while black. You cannot drive that in the city of Minneapolis, the city of St. Paul, or none of these cities around here if you are black at night, because they are going to pull you over. And they are filling their jails for their friends to have jobs.
Thank you for your comments. You're the director of the Council on Crime and Justice. Your group is undertaking this study. We have already laid out the fact that almost half of the prison population is minorities, while they're only 6% of the general Minnesota population. How do you go about getting to this? We talked about a little bit earlier that there are a lot of steps along the way. People don't just in society and then they're in prison. There are a lot of steps that they pass through the criminal justice system. You have worked as a county attorney. You've had an interesting perspective on this. What do you know so far?
Let me address that, but first one point, which is that the composition of the inmates within the prison system is not caused by any policy of the Department of Corrections. They take who comes to the front gate. So what we're looking at is what's happening prior to that within the criminal justice system, starting at the point of arrest. We know that there's a very large disparity, even as it relates to arrest. That is, minorities, particularly African Americans, are arrested at a much higher proportion to their population than is true for Caucasians. And what we want to know about that is how much of that arrest disparity is due to police policies, practices, reporting phenomenon, and how much of it is due to an actual difference in the crime rates. That's a very important piece of information for us to have. We also know that the disparity widens from the point of arrest to the point of the decision to imprison. And we want to know for what crimes, at what points in the system, and what are the plausible reasons that the disparity is widening.
You told me when we talked earlier that people have to have an open mind to the facts. Because you said that, I'm assuming that you're already anticipating or you're already aware of people are not having an open mind to the facts. And of course, this isn't something that happened yesterday in Minnesota. This is a disparity that's growing larger, but there has been a disparity for decades.
The disparity has been around. It is widening. Unfortunately, Minnesota is one of, I think, 12 states in which the disparity continues to widen. In most states now, 38, the situation is reversing. That is, the disparity between minority imprisonment rates and white imprisonment rates is decreasing. So that we've got every reason to study this now. And when you and figure out what's happening, what's causing it, and what are we going to do about it. When you look at population projections over the next two decades, the bulk of the two-thirds of the state population growth will occur within communities of color. And if you superimpose those population figures onto the current disparity within the criminal justice system, I think it raises serious questions about justice, but it also raises serious questions about can we financially afford to have that situation.
How long is your study going to take?
In total, it will take 3 years. There will be pieces of it that will be coming out as early as later this year, early next year. But in total, about 3 years.
How much is it going to cost?
The preliminary budget is about $3.5 million.
Someone might ask why your agency, a private agency, is undertaking this, and where is the great state rush? Where is the state government in rushing to try to figure this out?
Oh, I think that the value that we bring to this study is a perception of independence, and we're going to try very hard to be independent and to be objective about what the facts are before we sit down with lots of people around the table to analyze what do they mean and what do we do about it. I think the fact that we have a former governor and a former chief of the Supreme Court, two former public safety commissioners, a former district court judge, all on our board of directors, all help in terms of once we're at a point where we say, yes, these are some changes that we have to make. These are some policies that need to be changed. These are some practices that need to be changed. I think that we are well positioned, I guess, to advocate for those changes.
Representative Skoglund, has the legislature gotten involved? Is there a place for them to be involved? We saw the Supreme Court put together a task force on race bias, and they came up with the conclusion, harsher treatments for blacks, blacks, more lenient for whites. Is the legislature doing something as well? Or are you comfortable with this committee doing it, this council?
I don't think the legislature ever should be comfortable with anything. I think we should always be looking for information. And Tom does a good job. I'm sure that he's going to come up with an objective study that that I think all of us will welcome. But we're not doing any studies like that right now.
But you are waiting with interest to see what they come up with?
Waiting with interest for their study and everybody else's. I mean, we do try to see the studies, you know, what's going on. We've commissioned another recidivism study this year. I'm assuming that that study will also do recidivism by race. I'm looking at a recidivism study from 1997 that I have here, in case somebody's going to ask me a fact question that I need to reference. And we do look at that. We try to see how are we doing, what can we do better, how do we keep ourselves from repeating past mistakes and making the state safer.
We are in the Rush City Prison Library, and we have quite an audience with us today. Most of them are staff members who have joined us, but we also have a handful of prisoners, Rush City's prison's permanent residents. And Leif Anger, our reporter, is in the audience with one of them.
Yeah, I'm here with Clinton Strother. And Clinton, you're serving a third prison term. You've done time in Lino Lakes, in Faribault, Stillwater, in Red Wing, and in St. Cloud. So it seems like if anyone is qualified to issue a report card to this new prison, it's you. How does it compare?
It's pretty secure. They move us around when they want us to move around. We go where they want when they want us to, but it's the place works.
The warden was talking about the small cells, 7 feet by 13. You're not a small guy. How do you handle that?
It's tough. You try to stay out of it when your cellie is there. You try to stay out when he's there. When you're there, he tries to stay out. There aren't a whole lot of jobs here just yet, so it gets to be a little confusing. We haven't gotten out to the yard yet, so we're pretty much confined to the area of work and back to the block and in the gym.
Get along with the cellmate?
You have to get along with your cellmate.
No choice. So you're not working yet?
Yes, I am. I work in the kitchen, but so does my cellmate.
When do you get out?
I get out in June.
The warden mentioned the tight control. You mentioned the tight control. Is what is good for the warden automatically bad for you, or does it work for you too in terms of protection?
Well, it works for us and then it doesn't work for us. You know, we have all these different people in here and everybody has, they're all different. And so we have conflicts that come out of just being different. And being in that cell, the only thing you have is that you have a little bitty button called a duress button. If something happens in the cell, you got to get to the button. And if you make it to the button, you make it to the button. If you don't, you don't.
You ever press the button?
No, no. No need to.
Thank you, Leif. We go back to our phone lines. Marion from Northfield is waiting patiently on the line. Good morning. Welcome to Main Street.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question about mentally impaired inmates. I understand that there are a percentage of mentally impaired people in every prison. I'm wondering whether there's a different treatment, care, provision for people with those kinds of problems.
Good question. Commissioner, what happens when an inmate comes in and is mentally impaired?
We have a mental health program. In fact, we have, before the legislature this session, a bonding bill for providing specifically for the needs of the mentally impaired, both in our juvenile and our adult facilities, because Marianne is correct. There are a large number and increasingly larger number of people who end up in the correctional system with mental health issues. And so we try to address them. We try to stabilize people when they have problems. There are a large number of inmates who are taking psychotropic medication to deal with their mental infirmities, and we have psychologists and psychiatrists as well within the department who meet with them, conduct groups, do individual sessions.
There are waiting lists for these sorts of things, Commissioner. I found that troubling to know that, your chemical dependency treatment programs on the inside are full of people who have to wait to get into them.
That's right, Rachel. And again, it's a question of resources. It costs more money to provide treatment facilities, treatment services, and we do the best we can with the resources that we have, but we have to leverage our resources. And that's one of the reasons that the Department of Corrections, about 6 months ago, we entered into a partnership with Hazelden Foundation, Hazelden being the other large treatment provider in the state. And again, we're trying to leverage state taxpayers' resources by a private-public partnership.
We go back to the phones. Yes, go ahead. Representative, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, is Marion still on the line?
I am.
Yeah, were you talking about low-functioning people or mentally ill people?
I'm talking about mentally ill people.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought it was mentally impaired.
I have an additional question I'd like to ask while I have your attention. Are people with those kinds of problems housed separately from other inmates?
Do you separate those out and put them in one of the institutions rather than all of them, or you?
Well, we have
specializing with your prisons.
We have more seriously mentally impaired or mentally ill inmates separated out, and we have components of mental health treatment at a number of our institutions because the problems are so prevalent.
We're going now to Minneapolis, where Joseph is standing by. Good morning, Joseph. Welcome to Main Street. Joseph, go ahead with your question.
Hello. Can I hear you? Yes. This is a great discussion, and thank you for bringing it out. I think it's the beginning of looking at these systems. And I specifically want to talk to Representative Skoglund because although I think he's very genuine and very sincere and very informed about many things, I disagree strongly with some of the perspectives he has. And I would encourage Representative Skoglund to read some of the things that Angela Davis has written about the criminal industrial complex and how primarily it incarcerates poor people and poor men of color. And that's done for a variety of reasons and some of it for economic reasons. But my question to Representative Skoglund is what do you think stigmatization and negation does to men who come out of prison with no resources and are held by the system for many years? How do you think they recover? How do you think they move on with their lives? Because my observation and experience is that most of those men do want to move on with their lives, but if they have those felony convictions, the state watches them and holds them back and in a lot of ways encourages them to repeat. So,
Representative Skoglund, you want to take 30 seconds and respond to that?
Yeah, I think they do come out with a great stigma. I think it's harder to find employment, of course, than a person who's never been incarcerated. I think it's harder to find housing, and I agree. When he said that the state watches them carefully, yes, the state does. And I'll read a quote here. Among prisoners released in 1992, 59% were rearrested in Minnesota. And the Department of Corrections very closely monitors people who have been released from its prison, and they should. The Department of Corrections also helps them find work and helps them find housing, but I would agree that they are stigmatized.
And we're going to be talking about that next hour when this Main Street special continues. Commissioner Voss, I'd like you just to quickly tell us a little bit about the exhibit that's at Rush City today.
We have an exhibit showing the history of corrections in Minnesota. We've got a lot to be proud of in this state. We've had progressive legislators like Representative Skoglund. We've had progressive people within the Department of Corrections and with our community corrections focus. So we've got a display that shows the history of Minnesota corrections. It's going to be going statewide. It's at Rush City today.
And it's here today until 7 p.m. We're halfway through this Main Street broadcast. Our guests, Cheryl Ramstead Voss, Tom Johnson, Bert Mose, and Wes Skoglund. I'm Rachel Reeby. Next hour, we're turning our attention to life after prison. Some inmates say that's the biggest challenge of all.
And here is the writer's almanac for Friday. It's the 28th of April, 2000. It's the last Friday in April, and so it is Arbor Day, a day first observed in Nebraska, 1872, where it is still a state holiday. It was originated by a man named Julius Sterling Morton, who was president of the American Forestry Association, and it simply was a day for planting trees in Nebraska, which didn't have enough of them. And so on the first Arbor Day in 1872, Nebraskans planted 1 million trees. Today there's a national forest in Nebraska. Trees planted Arbor Day. It's 200,000 acres. Morton once wrote, "Other holidays repose upon the past. Arbor Day proposes for the future." It's the birthday of poet Carolyn Forché, born in Detroit, 1950, author of many collections of poems, including Gathering the Tribes and Burning the Tomato Worms. It was on this day in 1947, Thor Heyerdahl, the Norwegian explorer, and five companions sailed off on a balsa wood raft called the Kon-Tiki from the western coast of South America, heading for the islands east of Tahiti to prove Heyerdahl's theory that ancient people from the Americas could have colonized Polynesia. They were afloat for 3.5 months and crossed 5,000 miles of ocean. It's the birthday of Harper Lee, born in Monroeville, Alabama, 1926, who in 1957 submitted a manuscript to the J.B. Lippincott Company and was told that it was nice, but it was seemed like more like short stories than a novel, and she was asked to rewrite it, which she did, and in 1960, To Kill a Mockingbird was published. It's the birthday of author and editor Bill Blackbeard in Indianapolis, 1926, an authority on cartoons and comic strips and pulp fiction, founder of the San Francisco Academy of Comic Art, and author of the Smithsonian collection of newspaper comics. And it's the anniversary of the Mutiny on the Bounty, 1787. Captain William Bligh and his loyal crew were put in an open boat and arrived in Indonesia. Fletcher Christian and the mutineers picked up 12 women in Tahiti and settled on Pitcairn Island, where some of their descendants still live today. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, entitled, This Is Where. This is where the owl lives, pulled down from the sky by the strings of his hunger. And this is where the oak trees are lashed to the cup of earth they were born in. Forever, though every night they dream of unfastening themselves and floating away. This is where the field of the body dreams itself free of its silver veins, its weight. And this is where, inside every spirit, there is a man or a woman. There is the dark sulfur of memories, life singing and wringing its hands. The owl, at dusk, drifts out on his wings like a single feather, then wheels and descends like a swimmer returning in the undertow. Oh, this is where everything is on the wing, everything is on its leash, and the only art is the art of balancing. A poem by Mary Oliver, This Is Where, from her collection House of Light, published by Beacon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Friday, April 28th. Made possible by 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find more than 10 million used, rare, and antiquarian books. On the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
I'm Rachel Reeby. Do ex-convicts have the right to return home and find a job and a place to live? We'll be talking about that when this Main Street special continues after the news.
Stop daydreaming about early retirement and do something about it. Financial planner Paula Kennedy will help you get started this week on Sound Money. Saturday morning at 10, again Sunday afternoon at 5 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. It's 68 degrees at KNOW FM.